So today I want to discuss tight binding, and actually the tutorial this afternoon will continue on this theme. So as I mentioned yesterday, in the tight binding approach, you're imagining bringing these atoms from far away and forming a solid. So when they're far away from one another, they're more or less independent, and we get the old we'll call them hydrogenic, or they're actually called Rydberg states. And these are simply the hydrogen atom solutions. Okay, so if you've got an isolated atom, and it doesn't have to be that isolated, it doesn't have to be in the next room. I don't know how many of you remember or had a demonstration in one of your first year courses where somebody brings in a helium lamp or a sodium lamp, and you can use diffraction gratings, and you can look at the spectral lines being emitted by this lamp. And so you see the color yellow, or you see a slightly orange color, depending on what element it is, because this color is the wave, corresponds to the wavelength, which is the energy difference of two of the levels in that atom. So the fact that you saw a line means that those atoms were essentially independent of one another. Okay, but they were a gas, you know, inside that lamp. They're not in the next room. They're right beside one another, in a manner of speaking, but they're far, far away compared to how they would be in a solid. So in the gaseous state, even when there's 10 to the 23rd of these atoms in a close proximity, that's far away. And the atomic levels are correct, and you see a line. You don't see a band of colors. But when you come and form a solid, then you're putting atoms about 3.5-5 angstroms away from one another. So now they're no longer independent. So we want to use the fact that H atomic that we know these solutions. These are the atomic states. But the H you want to deal with is what I'll call H atomic plus delta U. And what is delta U? Well, you know, here's H atomic, but the next atom is over here, and then the next one is over here, and so on. And so delta U is everything other than this particular atom. These potentials actually leak over, in principle, over to where the electron associated with this atom is. And this is the delta U. Okay, and that's the part that we're going to assume to be small. If you've solved for the wave function here and you got, for example, a 1s state, then if this were basically zero wherever delta U was non-zero, you'd be done, right? And then this would solve the problem as well. But that's not generally true. There's a small overlap, and so that's what we're going to go after. So we're going to use block states, and these can be linear superpositions of all these potentials, or sorry, of all these positions. There's a plane wave component, and then you can simply sum all of the orbitals. That's that's what we could do. That's not a very good solution. It would work if, as I said, the wave functions for each of these particular atoms went to zero whenever delta U came into play. Delta U meaning they come from the other atoms. Is that's clear to everybody? So that's how we proceed in principle. In practice, that's not a good wave function. And what we do instead, so this is no good, we write psi of k of r is equal to sum over r e to the I k dot r times wave functions, which themselves are linear superpositions, so with coefficients b, say, of the atomic wave functions. Okay, so what we're essentially doing is using these as a basis. Okay, so this is going over all positions of the lattice, and then these are centered around each lattice point. That's the minus r here, minus capital R, and then what we use for those are linear superpositions of the 1s, the 2s, and so on. That is not ideal, and I'll show you why. So can I have the screen, please? So I'll connect my laptop.
Sorry, it's going to take a second.
Yep. So while we're waiting, does anybody have any thoughts on why this wouldn't be good? I mean, it turns out to be pretty good, and we are going to pursue it, but why isn't it perfect? First of all, do you know what I mean here? What I mean here is you know, I guess if I wrote N, L, M, you would recognize that more. These are the Rydberg states, right? The 1s, the 2s, the 2p, the 3s, the 3p, the 3d. It's not going to work in, it will work reasonably well, as I said, for this case, but I'll show you an example where it didn't work. It's not going to work in principle because it's not a complete set of states. Why isn't it a complete set of states? So where do these arise from? They arise from just looking at the Coulomb problem, a 1 over r potential, and you get all these bound states. And there's an infinite number of them. Well, I'll give you the answer in a minute, but you can ponder that in the meantime.
Connected?
Yes, it is. Should I disconnect and reconnect?
Yes, please. I don't have it.
Okay, it looks like it's working. Thank you. Okay, first, before I get to this aspect, this is a figure from Ashcroft and Merman, figure 10.1, and it's just showing you what is happening with the tight binding approximation. If you, so what they've, these are of course three-dimensional wave functions, but they're plotting this as a function of R, and one atom is right here, about 3.7 angstroms away from the other atom, which is right here. So they're plotting the 1s state, and they're only worrying about, even though it's a function of R, they're only worrying about going in that direction because that's where the other atom is, and that's this highly peaked wave function that basically is decaying exponentially here. So by the time it gets all the way over to here, it's really, really, really zero, or close to zero. And same with this one, there's hardly any overlap. Tight binding would be superb for the 1s state. But the 2s, for example, okay, it does go to zero about halfway in between, but it's just barely gone to zero. So there's some non-zero overlap right here. And for the 3s, even more extreme, the 3s is this one, and unfortunately there's I usually do this on transparency so I can mark them up, but the 3s is actually this guy. You can't tell at this crossover, but it actually carries on over here. Definitely not zero where the other atom is. Okay, and of course it's symmetric. The 3s for this guy is this one here, and it carries over to there. Okay, so those are not zero, and in fact the tight binding model would be dubious because they're not that tightly bound if you're going to discuss the 3s electron. And this is just that generic picture that I think I've shown before of saying, okay, here are those Rydberg states and their energy levels, but as you bring atoms closer together. So this is as a function of inverse spacing. So as you move to the right, the atoms are getting closer together. These levels spread out into bands. Okay, so that's the generic idea. Now back to this question. So let me give you, these are again publications actually within the last year or so. This one is the world's simplest example, and if you get me at lunch or something, I'll explain this to you. But right now I want to focus more on working with helium. So let me tell you, because we haven't discussed electron-electron interactions, even this picture where there are just these levels in the so-called Rydberg states, you don't actually worry about electrons interacting with one another. You leave out that part, right? You're just doing a one-electron problem. But helium is the simplest example where there are only two electrons, and you could imagine trying to include electron-electron interactions. Okay? So how would I try to include electrons? So this is just a single atom now. I'm sorry if I'm confusing things. This is sort of an aside from what we're focusing on, but it has the same problem that's here, so that's why I thought I would bring it up. If we're just worrying about one helium atom, I don't know, have you guys tried to solve the two electron problem in helium?
Well, I believe this problem is not offered in all quantum mechanics courses.
Okay. You probably, though, did it in perturbation theory, is my guess. You just said, okay, if you ignore the electron-electron interaction, you would put the two electrons in the 1s state. And because the Z for helium is 2, if you figure out what that energy is, you get minus 8 times 13.6 electron volts. So instead of 13.6, you get a factor of 2 from the fact that there are two electrons, and you get a factor of 4 from the fact that it's z squared, and z is charge 2 for helium. So that's minus 108.8 electron volts. The actual ground state energy of helium is minus 79 electron volts. It's way off. Why? Well, because you didn't take care about E squared over R1 minus R2 in the case of helium, because there are two electrons. And so what you might do is take these states and treat this as a perturbation and calculate what that energy is. And if you do that, you get, we'll call this BV, you get that the expectation value of that interaction energy using these states, these are not the right states, right? This is perturbation theory. Using these states, you get something like 34 electron volts. Okay, you can do that analytically. And so now you're down, you're back, minus 108.8 plus 34 is minus 74.8 electron volts. The real answer is minus 79, so you've got a lot closer. So what we thought we would do is try and do even better. How can you do better? By recognizing that the ground state, the thing that goes in here, is not this 1s singlet state, so 1s up, 1s down. It's actually, you know, when you try to put two electrons in helium, they spread out. They move away from one another. That's the classical way of looking at it. The quantum mechanical way of looking at it is they occupy linear superpositions of these states. Okay, a chemist called configuration interaction, but it just means that they form a linear combination of these states. Much like I've written here, this is a linear combination of these states. But this is all in one location. So you do that, and you calculate. So you calculate the energy now. And I put 1 over I max because the number of these states that you include, there are an infinite number of them, and I can't include them all, so I have to include more and more and more and watch this thing converge. So instead of this answer at minus 74.8 electron volts up here, this thing converges down and eventually settles in at a value that's much lower. But it's wrong, right? The real answer is minus 79. It's the wrong answer. So why is it the wrong answer? This is a quantum mechanics question, not a condensed matter question. Well, it's like I said before, this is not a complete set. Why is it not a complete set?
They're only bound states.
They're only bound states. The complete set is the infinite set of bound states plus the infinite set of scattering states. There are states, when you solve for the hydrogen atom, and if it's like I learned in undergraduate, you don't ever deal with the scattering states. You only learn the bound states. The scattering states are more complicated. Okay, they involve, you guys have ever heard of confluent hypergeometric functions? Sort of. Ever heard of complete elliptic integrals of the first kind? Yeah? You're going to see them in the tutorial. And they're a special case of confluent hypergeometrics. But those are what the scattering states consist of. So we don't generally learn them. And the lesson here was that if you want to get a good answer for the ground state energy, you need to take them into account. And that's why I've given you this caveat that in the current problem, which is an array of atoms, writing this out as a linear combination of the bound states will turn out to be pretty good, but it's not exact. If it were to be exact, you'd have to include the scattering states as well. Okay, and very often you don't worry about it, but this is an example where you had to worry about it. Otherwise, you were off by, you know, this looks like a little amount, but remember, I'm a condensed matter theorist, so this is in electron volts. This is off by about 1.5 electron volts, which compared to the 108 doesn't seem like a lot, but if you're a condensed matter theorist, you think in terms of degrees Kelvin, and this is over 15,000 degrees Kelvin, and I'm trying to understand things that happen at 10 degrees Kelvin. So that's important if it ends up having an effect. Okay, so can we put the screen up, please? I'm going to need it later, but I think for now we'll carry on with the board. So we want to use this expansion inside of here. Okay, so let me do it over here. I want to solve H times psi is equal to epsilon k times psi. But H I want to write as H atomic plus this delta U of R. And when I do that, I'll then write H atomic, H atomic times the sum over R, e to the I k dot R times sum of n over all n in principle, bn phi sub n of R minus R. Let me write H atomic plus V of R. Then I want to multiply on the left. On the left, I want to multiply by one of these basis states. So it should be a phi. Okay, and then I want to integrate. Okay, so this is, yesterday I used Braquette notation. Today I'm using sort of the old-fashioned notation. I'm just taking a basis state and then integrating over this. So this should have brackets like that. So if I do that, first of all, H atomic is Hermitian. It can go that way or it can go this way. And of course, I'm going to take it this way because when it operates on phi m, I'll just get, what did I call them? Capital E sub m, right? So let me, I'll get E sub m times the sum over R, e to the I k dot R, sum over n, b sub n, and then the integral d cubed r phi m star of r phi n of r minus uppercase r plus the sum of r e to the I k dot r, the sum over n, b sub n, integral d cubed r, phi m star of r, times delta u now of r
concrete, why do we have that integral?
Sorry, we have this Schrodinger equation. And then I'm going to take the Schrodinger equation as it's sitting here, pre-multiply by phi m of star, and then take the integral over d cubed r of both sides. Okay, which in the Bra-Ket notation would be multiplying by the Bra phi sub m and then taking the inner product.
And it's v of r, it's
just
w of r.
Oh, sorry, yes. Thank you. Yes. So this is equal to epsilon k times psi k. And to save writing, I'm going to write this as em minus epsilon k. That epsilon k is normally on the other side. It's multiplying by psi k of r, which is what I've this stuff is. So, but we've got to start separating out terms that are maybe big versus terms that are small. And so this sum over the lattices, this includes zero. This includes the site, if you like, that I've chosen to, you know, I focused on a basis state at site capital R equals zero here. So I should separate out those terms, right? Because when R is equal to zero, this is actually, they're orthonormal. This is actually one, only for M is equal to N. So I will get E sub M minus epsilon K, and I'm going to focus on R equal to zero, so E to the I K dot R is zero. This sum is going to collapse, and all I'm going to have is B sub M, plus the rest. The rest is EM minus epsilon K, sum of R not equal to zero, E to the I K dot R, sum over N, B sub N, and then integral d cubed r phi m of r star and phi m of r minus r. And that's equal to, or sorry, plus that. So all of this is equal to zero. So let me bring this thing over to the other side. So I'll bring this term over to the other side. So it's minus. But I should do the same thing, right? Because, well, all these terms are going to be small, we hope, because of delta U. So tight binding says that this is going to be small to begin with. And certainly if I make the lattice spacing the size of this room, that's going to be absolutely true. Okay, now, when the lattice spacing is 3.5 angstroms, it's not going to be as severe, but it's still going to be small, we hope. That's the whole hypothesis behind tight binding. So all of these terms are small, but especially small will be, again, the one where capital R is equal to zero. Sorry, it's not as small as the others will be the one where capital R is equal to zero, because then at least I have the two wave functions in here centered around the same integrals. Remember that first figure on the slide? It's really helpful if the two wave functions are centered around the same atomic site. So once again, just like I did on the left, I'm going to separate out the R equals zero. So this is R equals zero, this is one, and I'll get this minus the sub over N, B sub N, and then integral d cubed r phi m star of r delta u of r phi sub n of r. And then I'll put in the rest, minus sum of r not equal to 0, e to the I k dot r, sum over n, b sub n, integral b cubed of r. Like that. So I'm going to bring this term over to the other side as well. But now, I mean, I haven't even told you in detail what delta u is, but I know it's got to be something small. So I'm just going to take this and call it beta mn. I think it's often defined with a minus sign. Okay, it's just some number, and it's going to depend. Remember what these m's and n's are. They are these Rydberg labels. In principle, they're all three of these, NLM. So they're 1s, 2s, 2p, and they're in principle all of them. I'm also going to take this, and I'm going to call that minus gamma, and it's a function of r now. It's a function of how far apart these two, this is centered around position r equals 0, and this is centered around position capital R. And it's also got these labels, gamma sub m sub n. And over here, I'm going to just call this s sub m and n. So now if I rewrite this, I guess I want to write it the other way, epsilon k minus e sub m b sub m is equal to, so I bring this over to the other side, I'm going to make a mistake with a minus sign, but so that overlap integral S sub m was actually a function of r as well, uppercase R. And I have in here a sum over n and then a b sub n. And then I've got minus sum over n of beta mn b sub n. And then I've got a minus sum over r not equal to 0 e to the I k dot r of gamma Now, do I have the minus signs right, epsilon k? So that's...
I think that the first one, the last one, but the right side.
There's a minus there, right? And what was the other one?
The last one.
So I define this with a minus sign, though. So minus, minus, plus. So I think that's correct, right? So what is this? This is a set of equations, homogeneous equations for these Bs. In principle, I know or I can estimate all these, the beta, the gamma, and the S. Okay, so it's a secular equation in the B. So, and these Bs were, these are, you know, once I figure out these Bs, I've got a representation for the wave function that goes into here. Okay, so I have my answer. And these B, there's an infinite number of them. So I don't want to include all of them. And for one thing, I'm expecting that some of these things are going to be more zero than others. So one approximation the front doesn't go. One approximation is, suppose I'm interested, well, let's take that extreme example, the picture I had there of sodium, the 1s states. Let's just take the 1s states. The 1s states are really tightly bound. So let's use that. And I'm anticipating that all I need to worry about is the 1s states. So let's do the drastic approximation, if you like, of just consider the 1s states. Okay, that means that in these, so M is 1s. But also, in the sum over n, consider only 1s. Okay, then you're going to have, so let me write that out. It's epsilon k minus e 1s. So I'm just writing down this equation again, times b 1s. Is equal to minus the sum over r, not equal to zero. Well, we can use epsilon k minus e 1s here, and then it's the sum over r not equal to zero. And since I'm only dealing with the 1s in both cases here, this is just some overlap integral. If I want to write out what that overlap integral is, it's simply this overlap of the 1-0-0 state. The 1-0-0 state is one over root pi times z over a naught to the 3/2 times e to the minus z over r a naught. So you could actually plug this in and figure out what it is, right? It's, in fact, I can do that if you wish. And then here we've got e to the I k dot r minus beta. Again, I won't put subscripts on it because it's just the 1s times b1s minus the sum over r not equal to 0 of e to the I k dot r of gamma of r times b1s. And I left out a b1s. So I told you this was a secular equation. It was an n by n matrix problem. But since we made this assumption that we were only going to include the 1s states, it's a 1 by 1 matrix. So you can just go and cancel out this coefficient. And now you've got an expression for the energy. This comes over to this side, and then it goes underneath. So the expression for the energy is E1s minus beta plus the sum of r not equal to 0 e to the I k dot r gamma of r all divided by 1 plus the sum of r not equal to 0 s of r e to the I k dot r. Now, very often this term in the bottom is ignored. So if you take this expression for sodium, for z is equal to 11 and r is equal to 3.7 angstroms, so you just include the nearest neighbor, right? This sum over r, in principle, sums over all the points in the lattice. But if you just include the nearest neighbor and you get the answer you're going to get, so you can do this analytically, you will get s of r nearest neighbor is equal to e to the minus z r over a naught 1 plus z r over a naught plus 1/3 z r over a naught squared. That's what you get for that overlap. If you put in this value, remember what a naught is. A naught is Bohr's radius. It's 0.529 angstroms. And so if you plug that stuff in, this comes out to something like 10 to the minus 30. Okay, so it's indeed very small. So we often don't include this. And if we include only nearest neighbors, then you'll just have epsilon k is equal to some zero, which I'll call epsilon zero, plus the sum over nearest neighbors. And now this gamma is is a nearest neighbor vector. So let's so you're going to do the example of a square in the tutorial. But suppose you had a cube. Then here's, so the cube is like this. And if we focus on this atom right here, it's got a neighbor over here. It's got a neighbor over there. It's got a neighbor there, a neighbor coming out of the board there, a neighbor up there, and a neighbor down there. So that's what I've drawn here. And if I'm dealing with 1s states, 1s states are isotropic, there's no way that this overlap should be any different with the nearest neighbor over here compared to the nearest neighbor over there compared to the nearest neighbor in there. In other words, it should be isotropic. If these were p states, that wouldn't be true. So that means that this can come out of the integral as a constant, yes?
What is epsilon naught? Is
it E1? This should have been a minus. So this is just E1s minus beta. It's just a, usually you put it to zero because it's not important, right? But as it comes out of here, remember the first figure on the PowerPoint, not the first figure, the second figure, where it was a function of spacing, and this figure had the well like this, and that there was your bound state, and then it was a function of inverse spacing, and then this thing branched out. Right, so that zero is basically this level here, which is this, along with a possible shift because of the way you defined the delta u. Okay, so it's just for in practice you just make it zero. And now this is going to have an e to the I kx ax plus e to the minus I kx ax plus e to the I ky times ay plus e to the minus I ky ay plus the same thing for z. Because we've assumed the gamma is constant in all those cases. And we've only gone to nearest neighbor. We could, the next nearest neighbor is up here, and there's a bunch of those, and you could go ahead and do that. So you end up with epsilon k is equal to some constant minus 2 gamma, and these form cosines. And it's been misleading to put a sub y and a sub x because we've assumed it's cubic. And in fact, it was part of that assumption. That was an important part of the assumption so that this gamma came out as a constant. If it weren't cubic, that wouldn't be a constant in all the directions. So now you've derived the tight binding model for the band structure. And what's gamma? Well, 99 times out of 100, you don't try to calculate gamma. You parameterize it. It becomes your energy scale in the problem. And what does this look like? Again, we'll look at, I think we'll look at one dimension to make it easier. So in one dimension, it's just that. And so if you plot this, this looks like the cosine function. You only have to plot it out to pi over a. So this is a function of k and down to minus pi over a, because that's the first Brillouin zone in one dimension, and this so-called bandwidth is 4 gamma. So the width of the band in its entirety is 4 gamma.
This band, for example, in the case of sodium, it's going to be full, right?
It's going to be
full?
Yes.
It won't give us anything.
It's irrelevant,
about,
absolutely.
Electronic properties.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So Juan is saying, is actually, I have to repeat the question, right? Because they're picking up my microphone. So they didn't hear, on what's being recorded, they didn't hear your question. So the question was, or the comment was, that if we're going to deal with the 1S, it's actually full, and therefore irrelevant for any electronic properties of material. And that's absolutely true, because for sodium, you've got these two, and then you've got, now these are actually split, but let's not worry about that, because they're all filled anyways. So there are the two 2s electrons, and then there are the 6 2p electrons, and then it's the 3s state that has one electron, and that's the one we want to work with. I used 1s as an example because 3s is not so tightly bound, as you saw from that first figure. So sodium is not necessarily a good example for the type of metal that is well described by a tight binding model. In fact, the tight binding is often used for what are called narrow band materials as opposed to wide band. So in a good metal, the band of states that are available, you know, is electron volts, could be between 1 and 10 electron volts. In a not so good metal, it's much narrower. Remember, in the tight binding philosophy, this band started out as an infinitely narrow band. It was just a line. And now it's spread out in states. Okay, this is when we draw these figures where this spreads out into a band and I shade all this, the shaded part is this. Right, that's now the band that's over there of that width. I also want to make some contact with what we did with the free electron, right? Because if you expand this near k equals 0, you get minus 2 gamma 1 minus 1 half ka squared plus dot, 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 dot. So you get minus 2 gamma plus gamma a squared k squared. Okay, which is equal to some epsilon naught I don't care about, plus h bar squared k squared over 2 m band at k equals 0. So indeed, down here, down near k equals 0, this looks like a parabola. The cosine looks like a parabola. And insofar as it looks like a parabola, it has this dispersion, and you can define this effective mass. And in fact, that effective mass is simply given by h bar squared over 2 gamma a squared. So as gamma becomes smaller and smaller and approaches that limit of being a line, the band mass becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay, it's a lot harder to move an electron from one atomic site to the next. What else did I want to say? Actually, I'll show you some figures now. So can I have the screen down? Thank you. Any questions about that? I started doing this over here, and I actually did a derivation this morning. Remember what we did the other day? We wrote this as e to the minus kappa 1b over 2, and same thing with this, plus. And we brought it to the other side so that we had 2 e to the minus kappa 1b times cosine of kl was equal to the remaining part here. And remember, I wrote the remaining part in a very provocative way. I wrote it as a product of two factors. Like that. And in tight binding, so in the extreme limit, this is zero, because this exponential is just like e to the minus 50 or something. If this is zero, then if we're just looking at the 1s solutions, the lowest, there's no 1s here, sorry. It's a one-dimensional model. But if you're looking at the lowest even solutions, you're looking at the zeros of this. And you, I don't know if you guys, the way you solve that is you write it as tan k0 a over 2 is equal to k1 over k0. And if you let z equal k0 a over 2, then this equation is tan of z is square root of z naught over z squared minus 1. And if I plot the left-hand side of that, it's the tan function. The tan function looks like this. It has all these branches. So that's the left-hand side. And the right-hand side depends on z naught. But if I, so this is a function of z. If I choose z naught to be here, for example, then the right-hand side goes to 0 there. You can't have z greater than z naught. And it actually diverges as you go to the origin. So graphically, you pick up these three solutions. OK, and that's the three solutions you would have in here if this were 0. And they would just be the even state solutions. The odd state solutions are here. If I fixate on this guy, the lowest one, then and I want to include this, then z is not given by this equation anymore. That's the zeroth order solution if the left-hand side were 0. Z, in fact, is, let's call this z1. OK? Then z is equal to z1 plus a tiny amount, call it delta. Plug that in, do an expansion, and you can derive what delta is in terms of that solution z1 and in terms of this. Okay, and you will find that that solution, delta, is equal to is equal to a whole bunch of stuff times cos kl. And in fact, remember, z is equal to k0 a over 2. k0 was equal to the square root of 2m e over h bar squared. So by solving for z like this, you've actually solved for e. So e is the thing you would have got if this were 0. In other words, e is the answer you would have got if you just had one of these wells all by itself, and you solved here, plus a correction. And that correction is proportional to cos kl. So these are in the notes that will be posted online. I won't do it here because it's long-winded. But you get exactly you know, L here is like A here, you get exactly this form. So you can, I like this example because it's all meat and potatoes. It's all, you know, you can, you've got the exact solution at your disposal. You can do these expansions. The only part you don't like is the fact that Z1, the solution around which you're expanding, this one, you have to get that numerically. That's a transcendental equation, and we can't solve that. Okay, so that's a tie-in. Now, these tape binding models. So let's, why did I do it this way? Not sure. This is, we're going to two dimensions. So this is a now the solution you get for, I think that's about, that's a well of about depth 3 in those units. Okay, and these are the solutions. Okay, they don't look perfectly parabolic because there's that depth. So these are obtained numerically the way I described yesterday. You can take a slice in these solutions, which is you can go along ky. So I think here kx has been put equal to 0. So if we go back here, we're moving along this line, I believe. X prime is the one up in the Brillouin zone along the y direction. Okay, so we're describing this band. And the solution is the red curve, and this cosine fit, this tight binding model, is the blue. It's not that good. Okay, because we only went down minus 3. If we do the same thing where we go down to minus 10, I think, here, then right away, first of all, you can see this is practically a line. But of course, we're going to blow it up. And when you blow it up, it'll look like a curve with dispersion. And when you try to fit that, boom, it's you can't even see the red line. It's underneath there. The blue line is the fit, but the red line is the exact result. And the deviations are almost not there. I didn't emphasize it here, but when you have this, when you have a tight binding model like this, I worked out the band mass down here. The band mass over at pi, which is negative, has exactly the same magnitude as this. This is referred to as particle hole symmetry. What you have for particles down here, for a single electron down here, applies for a single hole up there. Okay, and that's not generally true, as I tried to explain last time. So particle hole symmetry has been, you guys don't have a background in condensed matter. If you're like me and you've learned a lot of condensed matter, all that's been drilled into me all my life is that particle hole symmetry is roughly there, when in fact it's not. But we try to emphasize, we overemphasize the symmetries, I think, it's to some degree. Okay, you can, I think I showed you this set of curves where you could just vary that height now and watch, I don't know, you could watch a number of things, like that blue band at the bottom, you could see it getting narrower and narrower and narrower until it's practically aligned. You can also do this in a different way. So what's happening here is the height of these barriers is fixed at 40 in these units. And then what we're doing is increasing the width of the barrier. So these are the actual wells. The two wells are here and here, and the barrier between them is being made bigger and bigger. And as that happens, these curves go up, the energies go up, but they also get very flat, all of them. Okay, and that's, you know, that's at the last stage with the widest barrier, and they look flat, right? Now, if you take an example, so I'm not taking this one in the next slide, but if you take an example, and this is 100 in those units, so it's a very deep band, and you do the diagonalization, and then you fit it to actually, this is not a fit. This is that derivation over here, where we actually, so it's no fit. It's actually using the numbers that come out of the model to determine the analytic form of the tight binding model. And you can see it works pretty well. And you should be more impressed when I show you the scale, right? So this is a line for all practical purposes. But if you blow the scale up enough, it will still look like tight binding. Okay, and this is something about Bloch's theorem. And it has to do with localization as well. What Bloch's theorem tells you is if you could arrange a periodic array of atoms, even if they're a kilometer apart, never mind angstroms or centimeters or nanometers or meters, but a kilometer apart, and arrange a regular array, you still have itinerant electrons. You still have electrons that whose ground state wave functions are a linear superposition of all those positions, as long as it's perfectly periodic. Okay, and of course it's going to be of no use because the bandwidth is so narrow, and any speck of dirt that gets in there will immediately localize the electron. Okay, but in principle, no matter how far apart these atoms are located, you will get conductivity in these Bloch states. So, and the Bloch states are extended; they're not localized. Okay, in 2D, I can show you. Actually, I can show you some pictures in 3D as well. So, in 2D, I don't know if this works. Yeah. In 2D, I can draw versus, so this is cosine kx plus cosine ky. Okay. It's still true that this is a paraboloid at the bottom here. This is what the dispersion looks like. What are these things? These things are energy contours. Okay, so you have to kind of get used to these because these are the energies, the curves of constant energy. And remember, we're doing this in 2D. You're supposed to start imagining this in 3D, where it gets a little more difficult. But in 2D, if you had a certain number of electrons occupying this band, say up to somewhere around here, then the curve separating the occupied states from the unoccupied states would be one of these circles. It's not quite a circle here, but if you went to small enough concentration, it would be a circle. Okay, because as I said earlier, you can expand the cosine here to look like a parabola, and if you're close enough to the bottom here, it is basically a parabola. Parabola goes like k squared, which the constant energy contour for k squared is a circle. But notice what happens when you go out further and further. It becomes this square, tilted square. Okay, and that's important for lots of properties because of something called nesting. So this is just some jargon that I'm going to tell you about. And the notion of nesting is that one wave vector maps a large piece of the Fermi surface. So this is a situation where suppose you had this band precisely half filled, which is often the case because if you use materials like sodium, now remember, tight binding doesn't apply very well to the sodium 3s, but if it did, then every sodium atom is giving up one electron. And that's half-filled, because every band, every orbital can take up two electrons, because they're spin up and spin down. And so if you have 10 to the 23rd of these, they give up 10 to the 23rd electrons that can now float around. So that's half-filled. Half-filling is the Fermi level would be precisely at zero here. So there's many states below as above. That's the particle hole symmetry. And right at zero, the shape of this Fermi surface is the square. So that's what I'm showing you here. There's that square. So now we're looking down flat on it. And all the things that happen in a material happen because of movements at the Fermi surface, okay, in a metal. What does that mean? That means, you know, if I apply a small electric field, there are electrons occupying the zero, zero state way down here, but where can it go? Can't go anywhere, because all the states around it are occupied, and the Pauli exclusion principle doesn't allow it to do anything. It's only the guys at the Fermi level, like right below the Fermi level, that can actually go just beyond the Fermi level, and those states are unoccupied. So the Fermi level plays a crucial role in this. And when the Fermi surface is a circle versus the square, it has profound implications. The square means, as I state here, there's one wave vector, this in this case pi pi, that connects a macroscopic number of states on the Fermi level to another macroscopic number of states. That's not true for a circle, right? If I start here and then draw a vector to go across, if I take that same vector now and move here and now go across with that same vector, I'm well away from the Fermi surface. So that costs energy. Whereas Fermi surface to Fermi surface doesn't cost any energy. When it's a square like this, though, you get this huge number of electrons participating in whatever phenomenon might be associated with this wave vector. And I list some things like charge density wave formations or spin density waves needs some kind of modulation of the electron density at some Q vector, and that Q vector will correspond to this nesting Q vector. So this is very conducive to instabilities that happen at a finite Q. And it's actually not good for, say, superconductivity. I mentioned density of states. Again, you're going to look at this in the tutorial, but let me give you a brief introduction. Are they doing this in the tutorial, the K-squared?
With K-squared, I did this on the preliminary.
Okay. So you got these answers, basically, for zero dimension, one dimension, two dimension, and three dimension. Okay, that's the density of states you should be used to. The ones you're not used to, by the way, how many of you have seen The Man Who Knew Infinity? It's a movie about Ramanujan. It's pretty good. So you remember the scene at the board in the classroom when Ramanujan is, at first, he's very bright-eyed and all eager, and the professor kind of gets annoyed with him and calls him up to the board to do something. Do you know what he's writing down an expansion for? He's writing down an expansion for the answer to your tutorial question, which is this. It's a complete elliptic integral of the first kind. So that's what's on that board, if you look at it carefully. He doesn't use this notation, he uses the definition of this. But it's I got excited. Anyways, that shows how easy it is to excite physicists. So this is the density of states for a 2D tight binding model with nearest neighbor hopping only. You're going to derive this, I think, in class. The thing you're used to, and the thing you've probably been told many times, is it's a constant in two dimensions. But that's only true for this parabolic band approximation, which is a significant approximation. The tight binding model is a lot more, it has its defects too, but it's more representative of what happens in a solid, and this is what the density of states looks like. It diverges, and it diverges right at zero. So if you go back here, why does it diverge at zero? See, when the density of states is flat, like here or up at pi, there's lots of states, and you're going to get something happening in the density of states. They're called Van Hove singularities. But the other place it's flat is actually at pi zero and zero pi out here, and it's a saddle point, right? It's a minimum in this direction, but a maximum in that direction. And it's that those saddle points that give you this divergence. The part at the bottom gives you this Van Hove singularity, which is not a singularity in the density of states itself, it's just a discontinuity in the derivative. So there's a cusp. But the main one is the one in the middle there. And if you don't like, well, you're going to learn to like complete elliptic integrals in the tutorial. But if you don't like them that much, there's a representation of the delta function, because the density of states needs a delta function. So delta of x is equal to the limit as eta goes to 0 of 1 over the square root of pi times eta squared times delta times e to the minus x squared over eta squared. So I don't know if you know that, but what you can do instead numerically is just choose some eta, I don't know, 0.001, and then simply do this integral numerically. I use delta here.
In equation 8, where is x and y under the exponents?
I wrote kx is equal to x pi over a, and ky is equal to y pi over a. So epsilon k is minus 2t cos x pi plus cos y pi in that expression. So this figure, for example, has both this and this. You can't tell the difference. These things are in Mathematica, so you can get them fairly easily. If you include next nearest neighbor, I haven't said anything about that, but if you include next nearest neighbor hopping, so now for a square lattice, instead of just hopping over to here and here and here and here, you're actually hopping over to here directly with an amplitude T2, which is T2 is that guy right there, then this is the dispersion. And then you can calculate the densities of states again, and there's always a singularity, okay, in 2D. And that's significant. And again, you can use these guys or these guys to calculate that. Because doing the algebra now for this is a little more tedious. If you go to three dimensions, then you've got different cases, simple cubic, body-centered cubic. You ought to be able to derive these just by going out to the nearest neighbors for these lattice structures. And if you go out to next nearest neighbors, they get even more complicated. And you can go ahead and calculate the densities of states, but I'm running out of time. I can't show you dispersions. If I were to show you dispersions, I'd have to show you a four-dimensional plot, right? Epsilon versus kx, ky, and kz. What I can show you are those Fermi surfaces. Okay, the Fermi surfaces. Now, if I've got a low filling, which I control with this parameter mu, I get a sphere. Right, so the Fermi surface is is the surface of this sphere. All the states inside here, and this is in the middle of the Brillouin zone, this cube is the Brillouin zone, and all the states inside it are occupied, and all the states outside are occupied. Remember what when we increased the filling for two dimensions, we got that tilted square? What do you think you're going to get for the Fermi surface when you now go to half filling? Half filling, this has all sorts of nesting features as well. What's the shape going to look like? Does anybody know what the shape is? It's actually that. It's called a plumber's nightmare. And the most impressive thing about this is, remember how that square, it's pretty obvious if I take the wave vector pi pi, I connect one Fermi surface to the other Fermi surface. Well, if you take pi 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 and you put this on any point here, it'll land on another point on the same surface. So it does have this nesting feature as well, only it's a completely different shape. And the densities of states look like, well, they were done back in 1969. This is a great paper that nobody seems to know about. It took 3 years to get accepted for some reason. I don't know why. It's been cited more than 140 times. But I've done polls at conferences about who who knows about this paper. And like over 20 years, there have been two people. And this is at conferences where I checked ahead of time. And I know that there's some people in the audience that have actually cited this paper, but they weren't aware of what the results were in this paper. So that's another lesson for you guys. Read the papers you cite. The density of states in three dimensions looks like this for a simple cubic. Okay, and again, I don't know if you've learned this at all, but the severity of the density of states tends to go down as dimensionality goes up. So in 1D, there were square root singularities. In 2D, there was that logarithmic singularity. And now there's no singularity at all, except there are exceptions. If you do body-centered cubic, there's actually a singularity in here. And this is the part nobody seems to know about. And remember, the Brillouin zone looks like this, so this is a complicated problem. To get the density of states for this problem, you have to get this, you have to integrate over this thing, not just a simple cube. So it's why it's not on your tutorial, or I presume it will not be in your homework either. I don't have much else to say, except you could do the look at the Fermi surfaces for the BCC. And unfortunately, these were produced 25 years ago, and I don't know how to produce them anymore. But if you had a smaller filling, there'd be a sphere, just like in the simple cubic. And you also have to realize you can't tell. I have a cardboard made thing of this at home that I didn't bring with me here. And it's cut open, and it shows you lots of things. You can't really tell, but there's an inner cube in here. And then there are basically, not these guys, but these guys. There are six pyramids that stick out of this shape. So it's like there's an inner cube followed by six pyramids that could be mapped back into the inner cube. And why that's important is I'm only showing you the inner cube here. I'm not showing you those outer pyramids because I can't draw that well. And if you keep increasing the filling, you get this beautiful cube, which is on the inner cube. So that's exactly half that volume. So this is an example where at half filling, you get a Fermi surface, which is a nice, beautiful cube, which was sort of what I was expecting for the simple cubic. And instead, we got that.
Actually, is this thing realized in nature?
Which?
Where?
Not that I know of. Oh. You mean, are there materials?
Yeah.
No, but I've run out of time. I could say Did I put it here? I can't remember. Let me jump ahead, FCC. There's a singularity there as well.
Because apparently you have to increase the filling in order to get this.
Yeah, so let me, the comment I want to make is, if you do BCC with next nearest neighbor hopping, that singularity is gone. Okay? But look at the blue curve. Look at that density of states. Okay? Remember that density of states. There's still a peak, but it doesn't diverge. And then that's, now I want to take you to nature. So I don't know how many of you are aware, but in the last year or so, there's been a new superconductor found at 203 degrees Kelvin. You have to apply a lot of pressure. It's hydrogen sulfide. This is a, what do you call it? It's a gas that smells like rotten eggs. Okay, so how does a gas superconduct? Well, you apply a lot of pressure and the thing becomes a solid. And then you lower the temperature and it superconducts at 200 degrees Kelvin. So people haven't quite done, what people have done is they've done these calculations where they see this density of states. Okay, never mind all the other stuff. They just see that density of states. They've even got Van Hove singularity in the title. Okay, and remember this one. Now, it so happened that I chose next nearest neighbor hoppings to all be positive. There's no reason why they can't be negative. If they're negative, this blue curve flips over and goes on this side. This has particle hole symmetry as well. Okay, there it is, flipped over on the other side. Now, that's what is supposedly happening in these materials. This is a much more in-depth calculation than this one, but you know, if you sort of, they look the same, and their origins are the same. I mean, these guys even comment on it. So, have they seen this in an experiment? Which is what Dennis asked. No, not yet. But this might actually be an example of a material in nature that shows not the singularity, not that Fermi surface, but something close to it. Okay, sorry for going over, but that's, so I'm gonna stop there. So next, I didn't get to density functional theory. I think next time, so tomorrow, I do wanna tell you a little bit about density functional theory, but then we will start into phonon dynamics.